America, we are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. At Grand Canyon University, we believe in equal opportunity, and the American dream starts with purpose. By honoring your career calling, you impact your family, your friends, and your community. The pursuit to serve others is yours. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.
Are you ready for an all-new season of Survivor? You better be, because Survivor 46 is here, and it's 90 minutes of twists and turns you don't want to miss. Better yet, after each episode, there's a brand new episode of On Fire, the only official Survivor podcast. Each week, we go behind the scenes of the episode's biggest moments, taking you into the how and the why things happened. And this season, we're very lucky to be joined by an expert, the winner of Survivor 45, Dee Valladares.
What is up? I'm thrilled to be joining this team and to be giving you my take on how and the why players made the moves they did, what it takes to outwit, outplay, and outlast, and to ask Jeff some questions, because even after 26 days out there, there is still a lot for me to uncover.
Bring it, D. Listen to On Fire, the official Survivor podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Comedy Central.
Hey, welcome to Beyond the Scenes, the Daily Show podcast that goes deeper into segments and topics that originally aired on the Daily Show. Like, this is how you got to think about this podcast. All right, look. If the Daily Show is a Christmas tree, we're the ornaments you use to decorate the tree. You know, the little twinkly lights and the little gold ribbons and all the little streamers that you put on the tree to make it look like icing. And then in January, when you go to clean up your house, you get caught in the vacuum and mess up your good-ass vacuum. I like Christmas. Today, we're expanding on a topic covered by Daily Show correspondent Dulce Sloan in a segment we call Dulcein, about the impact of HBCU marching bands. Roll the clip.
All of this marching band culture found a new home in 1890 when Tuskegee University started the first HBCU marching band. It turns out college and marching bands are a natural fit, like college and STDs. Over the next 50 years, marching bands popped up at Alabama State, Florida A&M, Kentucky State, and other HBCUs. But the big turning point came in 1946, when Dr. William P. Foster at Florida A&M discovered the missing ingredient.
Choreography.
Dr. Foster taught his marching band new dance moves with help from a PE teacher named Beverly Barber. And that must have been cruel for all those band nerds who thought that going to college meant no more gym class. Oh, you thought you were done running? Mm-mm. Now you gotta do it with a tube. But it was worth it, because choreography took marching bands to the next level. Adding dancing to anything makes it more entertaining. Karaoke, in-flight announcements, finding out you are not the father. By the 1960s and 70s, HBCU bands had gone mainstream. They were playing Super Bowls, and they even marched JFK's inaugural parade, which had to be the most memorable parade JFK was ever in. Wait, that seems wrong.
So recently, a junior over at USC, Princess Isis Lane, created the Cardinal Divas, which is a majorette dance team. Now, if you're not familiar with a majorette dance team, majorette dance teams are, they're a dance team that's rooted in West African dance traditions. And it's a fusion of, you know, jazz and hip hop and buck and step, and they do a lot of baton twirling. And a lot of these traditions started in the South and the Midwest, where these majorette dance teams would dance alongside high school bands and support high school football teams. And that tradition has matriculated up into historically Black college and university bands. And so the mainstream exposure for the Cardinal Divas, you know, they got a little bit of backlash, you know, whether or not activities rooted in HBCU culture should have a place in a predominantly white institution. So to help us delve into that a little bit more, I'm joined by Tech Elevator Pathway Programmer Developer, Bandhead, and HBCU Advocate, Dr. Christy A. Walker. Dr. Walker, thank you for going beyond the scenes with us today. First and foremost, how are you feeling?
I'm feeling great. I mean, that was a great intro. I appreciate it.
Well, you know what? I do what I can for, you know, my fellow black college brethren and sisterin, even though you didn't go to Florida A&M. Now, you know, you went to North Carolina A&T. Much love to the Aggies.
Yes, and much love first to the Rattlers. Y'all are good, too.
Thank you. Later on, we'll be joined by dance coach and owner of the Dollhouse Dance Factory and star of the Lifetime show Bring It, Diana Williams. But first, Dr. Walker, walk me through your black college experience and how you landed at North Carolina A&T. Because I'll give you my rundown real quick. My dad is Morehouse. My mama's FAMU. And so in my house, it was pretty much, look, you can pick any of these black colleges, but that's where you need to go. You need to go get some knowledge and you need to get a little bit of culture on top of that. How did you land at North Carolina A&T? And how did you end up in the band over there, the Blue and Gold Marching Machine?
Yes, well, the A&T and the Blue and Gold Marching Machine is literally in my blood. My parents met while being in the band at North Carolina A&T.
Now, wait a minute, that ain't allowed. You're supposed to be focusing on the sound. You ain't supposed to be fraternizing. The woodwinds can't be talking to the percussion.
Well, you know, stuff happens and, you know, I'm a band baby. What can I say? Yeah, so my parents were marching in the Blue and Gold Marching Machine. It was called the Marching Aggies back then in the 1960s. And so I just grew up, you know, just being surrounded in that environment, going to games as a little girl. I can remember being, you know, 5-6 years old, going to games. And I grew up in Hampton, Virginia. And so I can even remember going to Hampton University. Well, it was Institute back then, but Hampton University games with my grandmother when I was little. And I just always grew up in an HBCU environment. And so my parents were basically like yours. They said, you got to go to a HBCU. We don't care what you do for grad school, but for your undergraduate education, if we're paying for it, we're going to go to a black college. You're going to go to a black college. Mm-hmm. And so that's how it happened. My parents, they didn't pressure me to go to A&T like everybody thinks that. Like they hear that, you know, well, both of your parents went to A&T, they made you go. It wasn't that at all. It was just, you got to go to a black school.
You have a podcast called the HBCU Band Experience. And the discussion we're trying to have today is about the idea of black students who are creating black spaces for themselves at white institutions and whether or not that is a bit of a, I don't like the word violation, but does it cross a cultural line? Does it break a traditional standard? But I think the first thing we need to do is establish black college marching band culture from white college marching band culture. In your definition, because I'm going to tell you right now, I didn't play in no band. All right. I played flag football for about 2 weeks. That was it. I ain't do nothing to represent the school in any capacity other than write for the student paper. Having marched in a black college marching band, in your opinion, what separates an HBCU marching band from marching bands at other schools?
Well, I think it's a couple of things. I think, first of all, the music selection. So a lot of times HBCUs will play songs that are top 40 or what's on the radio, hip hop, R&B, pop, as opposed to, you know, folks at bands at predominantly white colleges, they may play more Sousa marches, John Philip Sousa, who's a famous march. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And so they will play that more of that kind of music. But that's one of the big things is the difference in music selection. And then I just think in showmanship, there are qualities that both kinds of bands have. But as far as like the showmanship, the kind of presentation they put out there, it could be even the marching style that they have to the announcer getting on the mic and talking a little smack to the other school. You know, you don't really hear that in predominantly white colleges. And so those are the biggest differences I can see.
Let's talk a little bit real quick just about the evolution of the black college marching band, because it wasn't always like that. Like, you know, let's be real. Black music started way before radio. So, you know, when we talk about, you know, the fact that, you know, a lot of black soldiers in World War II weren't allowed to carry weapons. And were assigned to be in the drum corps and say, hey, Darkie, give us some rhythm while we march down the street and get our parade, our victory parade for coming home safe. I know Tuskegee was the, if I'm not mistaken, Tuskegee was the first HBCU marching band in the 1800s. I think 1890.
I think it was 1890. There's this debate between Tuskegee and Alabama A&M having the first band, but Tuskegee, you know, we can go with that.
Okay. And so then let's talk a little bit about the evolution then. If that was the first band and that was just some drums and, you know, very African influence, when did we get into the choreography and the dancing and all of the more fanfare? When did the glitz start getting sprinkled in?
Well, I think it was more along the 1950s. So what happened was, you were talking about the military folks in the band. There's a unit called the Navy B3 Band that were around in during World War II. And it was composed of all Black musicians. And a lot of those musicians that were in the Navy B3 Band, they went on to become band directors at historically Black colleges. And so a lot of times they would get their graduate degree, their master's degree, or their doctorate from schools in the Midwest, mainly the Big Ten, because colleges in the South, because of Jim Crow, would not allow them to attend. And so they would pick up things from your University of Michigan's, your Ohio State, your Michigan States, and they would bring them down to the HBCUs, where they would take those Michigan fundamentals, but put a little bit of flair in it and play Motown songs and doo-wop songs from back in the 50s. So it really started in the 50s. And Dr. Foster from FAMU was one of the originators of that, if not the originator of having popular music and dance routines and things like that being in a Black college band. Like, he's definitely the pioneer. If there was a HBCU band Mount Rushmore, like, his head would definitely be on that.
What was really funny is I was at FAMU during Dr. Foster's last year, kind of like his last ride.
Okay.
And all of the home games were a tribute to Dr. Foster, and they always spelt Foster's name out, the Marching 100 did, on the field at halftime. And I just remember it being such a quintessential Black experience, because they would spell out Foster. You see it's Foster. We know it's Foster. But the announcer would always go F-O-S-T-E-R-A, Foster. I'm like, did you have to make R two syllables?
We'll have to ask Joe Bullard, because I'm pretty sure that was the person who was doing that.
Yes, it was. Now, we know that the marching band culture, at least for sure, we know it started in the state of Alabama. We don't know if it was up in Normal or if it was down in Tuskegee. That's fine. Dr. Foster and the flair and the World War II starts coming in the 1940s and the 1950s. Let's talk about present day Black college band culture. What are some of the things that set each school apart? I know the majorettes are there, the flag girls are there, but there's really no one size fits all with these marching bands. So, you know, what have they done? What have some of the bands done that you've seen in your analysis that sets them all apart from each other?
Well, different bands have different characteristics. So, like, for example, Southern University, they're known for their big, brassy sound. For a long time, they were an all-male squad. They have a very much masculine, aggressive, assertive kind of sound, which I really like. Florida A&M, their arrangements are second to none. They're known for having a very much symphonic sound. A&T, for example, my alma mater, their auxiliary is known very well. They're a group of women that can do it all, whether it's twirling the flags or whether it's twirling the baton or whether it's dancing. They're known in that aspect. I mean, I can probably pick something out that's unique about every band program. Norfolk State, for example, they are the Spartans, and they have a whole theme with the Spartan Legion, which is, you know, they have very militaristic kind of movements and the songs that they play. I mean, I can pick out something in just about everybody.
The thing I think that's also interesting is that, to a degree, there are people who go to Black college football games just to see the band. Like, that's always a long-running joke, but it's kind of the truth.
Like, yeah. It's not a joke at all. It's so serious. Like, I mean, I just had my homecoming a couple of weeks ago, and I remember, you know, just nobody moves at halftime, where at white schools, you've got people going to the popcorn stand or the restroom or whatever during halftime. Nobody moves.
All right, time for the popcorn. I'll be right back, baby.
Yeah. Yeah, nobody at a black college leaves at halftime. They leave during the third quarter. In fact, they may leave the game.
They may not come to the second.
Right, exactly.
So now we've set the table. You understand the history of black college marching bands. You understand the culture that it's attached to. So now you can understand why someone creating their own thing for themselves at a white school might have ruffled some feathers. I don't think it's that big of a deal. I need to back up off Princess Isis Lane. But after the break, we're going to break that down a little bit more and discuss everything that's going on over there at USC with the Cardinal Divas. And later, we're going to be joined by dance coach and owner of the Dollhouse Dance Factory and star of the Lifetime show Bring It, Diana Williams. This is Beyond the Scenes. We'll be right back.
America, we are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. At Grand Canyon University, we believe in equal opportunity, and the American dream starts with purpose. To serve others in ways that promote human flourishing and create a ripple effect of transformation for generations to come. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.
Love the Daily Show Ears Edition? Then help us get to know you so we can keep creating the content you love. Go to cohst.app/TDS or click the link in this episode's show notes to fill out a quick 2-minute survey and tell us a little bit about yourself.
Beyond the Scenes, we're back. We're talking about black college band culture. Now, Dr. Walker, we're going to be joined by Diana Williams in a little bit, but I want to talk to you first about what happened at USC with the viral video from the Cardinal Divas majorette dance team. Now, it caused a big divide and a lot of outrage between people that attended black colleges and people that attended white schools. Now, if you've never seen the video, it's just a group of black girls being excellent, doing the exact same things and moves that you would see at a black college, but they go to a white school. And so there were a lot of people that were upset. There were some people that were upset because they feel like this was an introduction into allowing white people to appropriate something that has traditionally been black. And in terms of protecting black culture from culture vultures, they felt like this was a way or an end to normalize. Because we all know imitation is the biggest form of flattery because all they do is steal from us on TikTok. But first off, Dr. Walker, what was your initial reaction to the video? As a black college alum, what was your first reaction when you saw this?
Oh, wow. Well, my first reaction was I was noticing little things that somebody who's not in our band world would notice. So when I first saw the video and I saw them dancing, I noticed their style of dancing wasn't as tight as I would like for a HBCU dance squad to be. I could tell that. To me, it looked like a bunch of women just getting together and doing a dance. Like, it didn't seem that tight. And I was noticing the people in the background, because they were doing it at a USC game, and nobody was even paying attention to them. Like, they looked kind of, I don't know, like out of place to me. So that was my first reaction. And then when I realized that it was at USC, I was like, well, why are y'all doing this here? There are, what, 107 HBCUs? Why couldn't y'all do that here? So that was my first reaction.
I'll tell you what I thought when I first saw it, Dr. Walker. Like, I was like, okay, you're trying to do your thing where you are. You're trying to have a piece of your culture at this place where you've chosen to go. And I understand the nature of, well, if you want a culture, you should have went to the place where the culture was created. But I just know that a lot of black kids end up at black colleges for a lot of different reasons. You in California, ain't a lot of black school. I don't know where she's from. Maybe you wanted to be in school close to home. Maybe this school had your program and it's a more esteemed, blah, 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 and the graduates go on to do more stuff. But As a comedian who has performed at white colleges for Black student unions, I know that they are always appreciative of there being a smidget of Black culture within this sea of whiteness that they delve into on a regular basis. So, you know, I don't know. I guess it didn't throw me off as much as it did a lot of other people. But do you think that Black college alumni feel that their culture is misunderstood by people who attend white schools?
I don't know if it's necessarily misunderstood, but it's more of like, I'll say it like this. Myself and the people that I interact with, a lot of them did not have a problem with this dance squad doing this. My personal issue is that they were getting all on national TV and talk shows. And I mean, even just, you know, this, like this podcast, bringing it up now, like they're getting all this shine while we have been doing this for literal decades. Nobody was checking for us, you know? And so why are they getting shine for doing what we've been doing all along and then kind of doing a halfway job of it because the dancing wasn't tight.
Because the dancing wasn't tight.
Yeah.
Yeah. Here's a question that I had with my team on my podcast. Shout out to Royce Job Fair, also part of the Comedy Central iHeartMedia Network family. Where is the line of where Black culture starts and stops in terms of it permeating into a white school? Because on the one hand, we could say, all right, hey, if you want to be a Black dancing group, go to the schools where there's Black dancing groups where you can be the best Black dancer and you can actually shine and do the thing the right way versus trying to create a culture for yourself where you are. So based on all of those reasons why you might choose a white school, I would assume that is also why we have Black Greek organizations on white school campuses. Is that same but different in the sense of Black culture that started at Black school? All those Black fraternities all started at Black colleges. They all have roots in the South. Is it the same, or is that different in a way because that is permeated nationally across all white schools?
I think the issue here is being a PWI student and claiming HBCU culture because you and your friends, when you were in school together, you and the Black friends at the white school, you know, had your own parties and your own this and your own that. And so I hear a lot of times, we were like a mini HBCU. No, that is not the same.
That's true.
that's my big issue. Like, that's not the same. Just because you and your 200 Black friends got together and did y'all parties and, you know, had your Black student union, don't claim that it's an HBCU experience. I definitely think you can have your own piece of Black culture. I mean, I don't feel like I am the gatekeeper of that in any aspect, and I don't want to be like thought of as a gatekeeper. So, I mean, people get with the groups of people that they can relate with. And when you're in an environment that is different from yours. So there's nothing wrong with bonding in that aspect. My one issue is that when you try to claim it's an HBCU thing or HBCU culture, or saying like, oh, let's throw a HBCU party. No. Don't. I mean, you know, it's like kind of like my culture is not a costume kind of thing. Like you can't cosplay it, like you were saying. That is my issue. Bond with your people. But don't put HBCU label on it, or don't say you were like a HBCU, because you're not. Sorry. That just really gets under my skin.
Clearly, but that's why we're here. That's why we're here, and that's why we're grateful that you were on the podcast. Thank you, Dr. Walker, for going beyond the scenes with us. After the break, we'll be joined by dance coach and owner of the Dollhouse Dance Factory and star of the Lifetime show, Bring It, Diana Williams. We'll be right back.
Love the Daily Show Ears Edition? Then help us get to know you so we can keep creating the content you love. Go to cohst.app/TDS or click the link in this episode's show notes to fill out a quick 2-minute survey and tell us a little bit about yourself.
Now, we need to get a little deeper into the weeds of majorette dance teams, the styles, all the different styles of these teams, the importance of exposing this dance form to Black dancers. And here to help explain all of this, I'm joined by dance coach, owner of the Dollhouse Dance Factory, and star of the Lifetime reality show, Bring It, Diana Williams. Diana, how are you doing today?
I am fun. I am fabulous. I am fit. I am blessed. I am favored.
You are all the things. Also, your background is sparkling. That's coordination right there. Coordination.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you.
Now, you attended Jackson State University, pardon me, the Jackson State University for college. And, you know, before we get into the Black dance culture over there, just start with me and talk to me a little bit about your HBCU experience and, you know, what was it like there for you at Jack State? And then also, what drove you to choose that school in the first place?
Wow. Okay. So Jackson State University has been a part of my bloodline since I was born, literally. My mom went to Jackson State University back in the 70s. She pledged on the campus, Delta Sigma Theta, in 76. I was born in 78. So it's like it's been throughout my life. To know, I was supposed to go to JSU. Like everything about me was Jackson State University. I've come from a long history of HBCU participants in my family. When I say participants, meaning they attended school, Morris Brown College, Morehouse College, Clark Atlanta, you know, it was all a part of my family. Jackson State University is a school that I can't even really call it a school. It's more like an experience. It's more like a state of mind. You know what I mean? Because when you walk onto the campus, you instantly feel like this warm air around you where you feel like you're a part of a big family and you're at home. You know, I'm Southern. I'm from the South. So everybody speaks, what's up? Hey, how you doing? You know, it's the yes, ma'am, no, ma'ams. You know, it's the normal ambiance of just love and that family feel. And when I was on the campus of Jackson State, I went to Jackson State in 2001. I graduated in 2005. My experiences there were life-changing. They were unforgettable. In so many ways. There were some great experiences, there were some bad experiences, but they were all life-changing and life lessons. I started my dance team while at the school. My dance team was given their first opportunities for large performances at the school. It's because of the school. Yes. It's because of Jackson State that I am who I am, if I'm being very, very honest. You know, I tried out for the dance line at Jackson State, the Prance and Jay sets, over six times and was denied every single time. And it wasn't until, you know, Lifetime showed up with this TV show that it's just like a light bulb went off and said, okay, I was never supposed to do that anyway, because if I did, there would not have been a this, because there wouldn't have been time for it. I needed to grow my company, grow my brand. The team needed to be good to be on TV. So how in the world could I have done both? During those 4 years, 2001 and 2005, were the prime years that the team was founded, the foundation, the core, all of it. And it is because of Jackson State allowing the kids to perform at the football games, the basketball games, performing at JSET tryouts as the feature performers that we got our start, and everybody started to really pay attention to these kids.
That's a beautiful story. Now, much like yourself, I tried out for FAMU's baseball team twice and was told, no, I'm still waiting on God to give me my blessing in Major League Baseball. I'd be a 43-year-old rookie at some point. Let's break down the roots of majorette-style dancing. And what is it that you think that separates it from all of the other styles of dance? Like, what sets all these teams apart from one another? Because, like, you can all be majorette dancers, but you all can have a different type of sauce, right?
Right. Oh, absolutely. Well, let's just start with the first part of it. Majorette dance, in my definition, it is like a pot of gumbo. It is a mixture of every style of dance that exists, from square dancing to folk dancing to clogging to ballet to jazz to liturgical to hip hop to modern, because majorette dance takes you on a range of emotion, and it doesn't just lead you to just one place. You could get really, really hype, or you can be really, really chill. You can be really, really sassy, or you could just be really, really demure. It depends on which direction you want to go. Versus ballet is very structured. It has to be this, it has to be that. Hip hop is very this or very that. But with majorette, it's all of those things. It even encompasses African dance and gymnastics, because you got the tumbling skills. These kids are doing pop-ups off their heads. They're doing helicopters now. There's all kind of things that the trends have changed, you know, with majorette. So when I look at the style of dance that is my profession, it is awesome in so many ways, because you can't put it in a box. You can't put it in a box. And when I look at the different majorette styles of all of these HBCUs, every single one of them got their own sauce. It is like how you got your different types of hot sauce, different types of barbecue sauce, different types of Creole seasoning. You know, it's not the same. It's similar, but it's not the same. You look at Jackson State University, they are your acrobatic, very structured, aggressive style of majorette. You look at the Golden Girls, they're more of your African dance, get low, very aggressive majorette. You look at the Alabama State Stingettes, they're like the Naomi Campbell of the SWAC. They're just very just like, yes.
Elegant.
But then, but they have a little bit of extra little fire because, you know, Naomi Campbell got a fire side to her. But then you go to the other side and you look at Southern University. They're like Misty Copeland, very much so technical, very much so just prim and proper. Put me in a box. I'm very cute. I'm not going to do too much to sweat. You know, they're every one of them are very different. But then I recently had an opportunity to meet Texas Southern, the dance line, the Motion. And they're all over the place. Like, they're all of these things that I disdain from all four schools. So it's just no one way to explain it. And each school just has their own swagger. It's kind of like women. You know, we as women are different shades of melanin. We have a different attitude, a different way we walk in pair of heels. That's the way we talk. Same thing with guys. But having this conglomerate of things and being so different is what makes majorette so awesome.
And your show, Bring It, right? Mm-hmm. You have figured out a way to present all of these different sauces to the world through, you know, through this type of competition. And the competitiveness of this, the idea that I'm the best and that I'm going to try my damnedest to show you just how amazing I am. When you turned on your Twitter that morning, you turn on the Twitter like a television, I'm so old. When you opened up your phone, and you see this video of Princess Isis Lane, and you see her doing a lot of these different styles, and the Cardinal Divas doing this thing. You know, it caused a huge divide between the Black college and predominantly white institution community.
It did.
Between the Black college alum and non-Black college alum community.
It did.
What was your initial reaction? Because you are essentially a curator of this. You are a sommelier, if you will. Of Black dance and Black majorette culture. What was your first reaction when you saw what you had done and what you had seen, you know, championed so well at so many Black institutions happening at a white institution?
I didn't look at it as an HBCU PWI thing. It's just dance. I just looked at it as a young girl deciding that she wanted to do something and she just did it. I guess I'm the wrong person to ask that question. Well, I guess I may be the right person because, I mean, I go against the grain. I'm going to do what I want to do anyway. I don't want nobody telling me what to do. I don't care if I'm in the middle of the cornfields or standing in Alaska in an igloo. I'm going to do what I want to do. And I don't care who's around me, who's talking about it. Nobody can tell me different. That's just how I move in life, period. So seeing this girl create this and doing it at this, I didn't care about the school. Like, that just never dawned on me. Oh, she's Black at a PWI. Like, that never dawned on me. I was like, oh, I like the curls in her hair. Oh, she's cute. Oh, they look great. Oh, this is interesting. Why is everybody so mad? Like, I had a range of emotions. Like, it didn't dawn on me. So when I realized that she was at a PWI, I still was just like, I didn't get it. I didn't get my husband another conversation. He was pissed, but I didn't get it.
but this idea that Black culture can often be misunderstood if not presented in the proper context within a white space, did that not give you a fear or concern of the possible appropriation? And we know that Princess is doing her thing. She clearly has studied the culture. Like, it's not like she's someone that's not of Black culture that was just trying to copycat some stuff. But do you not have a fear or concern of people going, of white majorette teams, if not at USC, whoever, whatever school they're playing, looking across the field and going, oh yeah, maybe we need to put a little sauce in our thing. Maybe we need to put a little Naomi Campbell in our white thing.
But they're already doing that. They're already doing that. I watched it on the show that I was on. I was on Bring It, but then you had Dance Moms on the other side of it. We've been doing dev drops and head pop-ups and tie kicks and toe touches forever. Then all of a sudden they do a dev drop on their show and it's like, oh, I'm like, what? Like, we've been doing that. Like, what are you talking about? We went to a competition that was white structured. It was a national type event. It wasn't our thing, and there was not even a genre for majorette to check off a box. It's kind of like you go black, white, other. We were the other in the building, and it was weird. So I understand, you know, HBCU culture, PWI, the black, the white, the different styles of dance and how it could be, it could feel. I understand, like, how I personally felt as a dancer. To me, dance is dance. But if I'm looking at it outside and everybody else's retrospect and their understanding, I can understand how everybody feels, because yes, she is in a PWI space doing a culture of style of dance that we've cultivated, that we've created, that we have nurtured and loved on and made it to be this awesome sauce. But this is no different than any other thing in the world that we've been doing. From straightening our hair to curling our hair to wearing certain clothing, and even the hip hop culture of corn roll braids. And it's like nothing, it's the same. So I get what they're saying, but I'm trying to find the right word to make it make sense, because I don't, to me, she looked like me, Roy. She looked like me. And I'm like, regardless of where she is, it shouldn't matter. If she is creating a lane for herself there, I don't personally have a problem with it, but I can understand how someone's saying, well, they're stealing our culture. She took our culture there. Why not just go to an HBCU? Why talk to Princess? And I asked her those questions, you know, and she just said that she's from Chicago. And she just said that, you know, when I was in school, I had to go to school online because of COVID. I couldn't be in the school system. And then, you know, I went to the school because I'm assuming that diversity was something that they were looking for in their school. Just like, we look for diversity at HBCUs. And maybe the school offered her a full ride or a scholarship or whatever. And she had to pay nothing for school. I don't know. I'm assuming.
Yeah, I don't feel like Princess owes an explanation to black folks why she didn't want to go to no black college. I don't, like, I almost hate that question was posed to her. You know, I do, when you look at other aspects of black culture stepping into mainstream, I don't think what she was doing was some sort of unprecedented thing. Not when you got marching band, black college marching bands playing during the Super Bowl. Shout out Florida A&M, played with Prince in Miami at that Super Bowl. Also, you know, if I'm not mistaken, there were marching bands that was part of Biden's inauguration with Kamala.
Yeah.
When Biden and Kamala were doing the inaugural parade. So is that a black band in a white space? Because what is showcasing blackness versus you're setting us up to have our culture poached? And that's the line that I feel like everybody that's mad about it can't define clearly. Not when you have black fraternities and sororities walking around.
But how is she? And then you have Caucasian students and other students of other races that are pledging these fraternities and sororities. So are they setting us up to have our cultures stolen by someone? I don't get that. Like I don't get that. I just hate that she's not setting anybody up for anything. Because if they're gonna steal it, they're gonna steal it anyway. You know, you got people that have mixed, we all mixed race, because Massa was raping, you know, the slaves when and all of us coming out in different colors. Hell, my background is Indian, Cuban, white, black. I got so much mixed up in me, child. I be trying to figure out, am I the hood side today? Am I bougie? What am I? You know, because some days I don't really get it. When I say get it, meaning like it's not that big a deal. It is, but it isn't. I am pro-black. I am Black Lives Matter. I am shop black, buy black, support black. I am all of that. And I think with that is the reason why I was so supportive of Princess, not because she's in a PWI space, but just because it's her. And I never want anybody to stop their dream or stop chasing something for whatever her reasons were, simply because your own people don't accept it. I mean, and let's be clear. When Bring It started, my own people came after me. They told me I got my black girls on TV dancing like strippers. And I was like, what? I like, wait a minute. Did our African ancestors not talk to the top? Like, I'm confused.
The blackness to everybody. That's our secret.
Listen, I was confused. And I love my people. I love being a black child. I wouldn't change anything about me in the world, but this is crazy.
Did you get any grief for being on Lifetime and not a black network?
It wasn't that. It was more of, I was told that I am dumbing down myself for this network and I'm not being my natural self. Now, if you watch that show, you know, everything about me was me. So I don't know what they talking about. But at the same time, it was me kicking down doors and opening up another opportunity for us to be seen on television. We're the fastest growing show in the history of that network, period. That's Googleable. Like we're an all black cast of young kids doing a style of dance that nobody really even talked about until we got on TV. So Lifetime, us being on that network, to me, it really helped us cross another line. It's kind of like a black star becoming a pop star or a country singer. You know, we're crossing different lines and showing that we deserve to be in this particular space.
So you start this group at Jackson State. So you know of the hurdles when it comes to starting a group. Now, it's one thing to talk to Princess and give her emotional support and talk to her about the backlash, but what were some of the other blind spots that you were able to hip her to? Like, just in a support, like how do you offer support to Princess and the Cardinal Divas? Like, what other things did you look at that and go, oh, she gonna need this, and that. I gotta get this girl on the phone.
Mm-hmm. Well, I started Dancing Dolls at a community center in Jackson. I just so happened to go to Jackson State at the time where my team started. So I didn't start mine like she did hers. However, what I did tell her was that they needed costumes. I just feel like they need a look. They don't have a look. Something that sets them apart from everybody else versus them just being in a uniform that they created or something that they bought a sports bra and some briefs and they're out there. They need an overall look. She needs overall structure. They need to understand the style of majorette. They need to understand the background, the culture. And they also need to start paying tribute and respect to some of these other teams. Because it's like if when I started Dancing Dolls, I always gave respect to the Prince and J-Sets. Always. We call our walk J-Set walk. Like we created costumes and named them after them to show respect for who came before us and where did I get it from. Right. She didn't do that. And it's like, you have to let people know, I started this because I saw this. This is a team that I love and show grace to, and I love what they do. I want to create my own space in this world, but I need to pay homage to these other teams and show respect. And let people know that this is what you're trying to do. And I think that it will come across. It probably, people still probably going to be mad, but at least it'll come across a little bit differently. The biggest advice I did give her, though, I did tell her about their overall look, and they needed to have some structure with choreography, for sure, for sure.
It sounds like everything you're talking about costs money, though. How do you fund an operation like this? Because I don't know if this counts as a student activity group or if it's an actual covered by USC football booster money or whatever. Like, how do they get money to maintain this? Because you're talking about costumes, you're talking about choreography, you're talking about renting the space to do the dances, you're talking about doing 20 people's hair.
$20
haircut. Now they can't just all get a booster for you.
Well, you're right about that. No, I did, but I did have this conversation with her, and she told me that they are officially a student organization on campus. So she did do that part of it right. They were given a space to practice in. But when it comes to costuming, if you're starting up something, any business or anything, what you have to do? You got to invest. You got to invest in yourself. And if you're a college student, you know you want to get something done a specific way. Okay, I need to figure out if I'm going to take out a student loan. Am I going to get a grant? Am I going to get a job? If I need costumes, what do the costumes look like? What does the pricing look like? Even if they got just one something for the whole particular season. Princess has gotten a lot of notoriety behind this. There's a lot of people that have, she's been on the Jennifer Hudson show. She's been on all these different news shows. She's been everywhere.
Yeah, gave her a shout out.
Yeah, she should be using these opportunities, not just a viral, but to build a business, not a business, but I guess my head's always in business, but to build another business space for her to make money. And it's like, do you start a GoFundMe? Do you create a donation account where there's monies there for you to be able to get donations for your kid, for your dance line? But then on top of that, Roy, the world we live in now is black women. We wear wigs, we wear weaves. You can get a wig made that will last you a full year and get your braids done underneath it for $30 every time you have to perform. It's a one-time thing. Trust me, I know, because I got almost 100 kids and they all wear wigs, and we got one wig done at the beginning of the year. They get their hair braided, spend $30 every time they get it done.
All and that it's a head way to do whipping it. And neck snapping, that wig be just staying together.
It's good sewn wig down. It's sewn down. It's sewn down.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure that somebody would want to donate their time to have an opportunity to work with Princess. And I'm going to tell you two people I know for sure. One, her name is Jesslyn Stiegel. She is a former member of the Jackson State University Prance and J-Sets. She lives in California. She offered her services, and she said that she would be happy to coach them. Also, a makeup artist by the name of Monet. Monet was my makeup artist for 3.5 years for the Bring It Live tour and on Bring It. She's awesome. She lives in Los Angeles and is willing to donate services to them as well. I offered to purchase a uniform for the girls, and I also offered to come to California during basketball season to help them with choreography. Because my thing is, it's like, if I'm not a part of the solution, then I'm a part of the problem. If I can't donate a dollar to them, then I'm not going to talk about it. I'm not going to sit back and be like, look at them, look a mess. But I'm not doing anything about it. So, but there are people that are willing to help. She just has to be willing to get in the right space to be able to do that. And then on top of that, you can't come with your fists like this because you're going to miss out on your blessing. You got to have your hands open to be able to receive it.
I think that a bigger issue that was kind of buried in all of this, in my opinion, is that I think that this exposed to some degree why a lot of Black kids don't go to HBCUs. And it's not always because they don't want to. And there was a conversation happening underneath the surface about that, because, you know, a lot of kids are from states that straight up don't have a Black college and they can't afford the out-of-state fee. I went to FAMU out-of-state from Alabama, and I tried to get in-state my junior year. They said if you get one bill in your name for a year, you can get it. But I didn't know you also had to have a Florida ID, and they got my ass. Why is funding essential to remedying the issue of, you know, the number of Black kids across the country who often choose a PWI over a Black school?
Money's gonna always be an issue for everything. If you don't have the money, you can't move like you want to move. It just is what it is. And I know kids, I love my girls. Okay, I have girls on my dance team now that cannot select an HBCU because the schools of their choices are states away and they cannot afford to go. They may have a scholarship, but it's not enough. The scholarship may be enough for tuition, but it's not enough for housing. They may have
like the dance scholarship or the dance scholarship.
No, they're academics. They're okay, academic scholarships. As I always tell my kids, don't base your life based off of dance, because when those 4 years are over, you still have to have a career and a way to make a coin when it's over with. So you're going for a degree. So make sure that's like the top priority. So when they decide, hey, I want to be an astronomy major, or I want to go into cinematography, you know, the places that have their majors are not always HBCUs, and the ones that do have it, they're so far away, or they don't want to dance on this team, they want to be on this team, but this school doesn't offer this, that, and the third. And outside of even the dance part of it, the academic part of it, they may just not have the means or the motive to be able to get there. And some parents are not willing to let their kids go either. They don't want their kids to go that far. They want to keep them close for whatever the reasons may be. Money and funding is going to always be an issue for these kids trying to make a decision to go to school. And we can't ridicule those that are not able to get there. And I'm not saying pity them either. I'm just saying we just have to have an understanding for each other as a people to say, you know, maybe they weren't able to get here for whatever the reason may be. But if I'm able to give them a little bit of my HBCU experience when they come to visit, or if I see them, let me explain to them what it's like being on the campus of your FAMU or your Fayetteville State University or your Winston-Salem's or your Bethune-Cookman's. Let me give them a little bit of what I'm getting so they can see another side of life, because I do feel like a lot of us are missing out on culture and love and that family feel from our people because we are at other schools. And then when you get to an HBCU or you're around a lot of Black people, you're assuming, oh, they're going to be this or that based off of what you see on the news. There's a lot of educated Black women and men in the world come out of these HBCUs, but because we're not PWI, we're assumed to be beneath the rest because we're not a part of what they assume to be the best. You got some of the best doctors and lawyers and judges and police officers coming out of HBCUs. I just don't get it sometimes with the way we treat each other, but it's just, that's a very sensitive topic for me, because I've just been treated multiple different ways, even at Jackson State, even when I left Jackson State and I was in the entertainment industry, being on the sets of the different places that we had to go for Bring It, and I was treated in multiple different ways, and I had to contain my Blackness, and I had to not Don't be this loud ghetto black girl, you know, because they got you effed up. Like, don't do it, girl. I had to constantly have conversations with myself because I'm like, I'm in a different space. When I go to the corporate offices, I have to be this or that, you know, because they expect the wow and pizzazz, and I can't be myself. But I had to use my HBCU education is what got me through being on that television show. Jackson State taught me how to fight using words. Jackson State taught me how to think, utilizing my degree and what I learned in those classrooms by critical thinking. I have a criminal justice degree. Learn how to argue without arguing. One of my teachers always told me that. Learn how to argue without arguing. Learn how to speak your mind with authority without being afraid of your voice being too aggressive because you were a woman and because you're black. Learn how to speak and present and talk and command a room no matter where you go. These are things that I learned at my school. But I also learned that no matter where you go or what you do, somebody gonna try you, and you gotta be able to have that ethnic side, okay? And you gotta also be able to have the professional side where you can turn it on and turn it off. And I do feel like I love all schools and all people, and I have to say that because I feel like people gonna get me. But being at a PWI, you ain't gonna get what you're gonna get at an HBCU. And being at an HBCU, you're not gonna get what you're gonna get at a PWI. It goes both ways. But looking at the Princess situation, it's just, for me, she's trying to blend both of what she knows and feel comfortable on both sides.
Then we'll end with this question then. I feel like what she did was net positive for the culture. Mm-hmm. Why do you think it's important, or do you think it's important? I think you do. Why do you think it's important to have something so culturally specific, be it a dance team, majorettes, Black Greek organizations, hell, a Drake concert? Why is it important to have culturally specific things at a space, at a PWI? Because, you know, I did a ton of comedy shows for Black student unions at white schools. And the Black Student Union's job was to bring something culturally specific to the campus. So in Princess's case, why do you think that was important?
People need to see who we are all the way across the board. And again, stop trying to put this category or this label on who you think we are. Like they, and I think that what Princess did was she showed a different style of dance that some of them are trying to do. Because there are other dance teams that do exist at all these at some PWIs, but Princess is the first person that just kind of went viral for it. But there needs to be a space where people do realize that Black people are multifaceted and multi-talented. Yeah, you see the different artists, the different rappers, the different singers and songwriters, but there's other, what else is there? And then on top of that, there's no Black sheroes in dance anymore. Misty Copeland was there for a while, and she was a part of the American Ballet Theater. She was a Black ballerina. That don't happen. So she crossed over lines. So we need to always be represented in every sense of the space so that we don't become invisible or disappear or they forget. Then it's like, oh, I didn't know that happened. Oh, I didn't know that was a thing. No, you need to know. I went through this on Bring It. I went through this being in a dance mom space. I will never forget how I felt. Right? I was pissed. I'll never forget how I felt. And I was trying to keep it together because my girls are looking like, oh God, we don't belong here. I'm like, you belong anywhere you want to be, child. You supposed to be here. We here. Let's go. We finna turn up on their stage. Like, our parents were cheering and the rest of the crowd is like, oh my God, they're yelling. We're like, what? Like, y'all don't yell at a competition. What we doing? I just remember how I felt in that moment. So when Princess came out with this and the world is yelling at her, I know how I felt, and I put myself in her shoes, and I'm thinking, this Black girl just want to rock out. This Black girl just want to dance. It's not about Black versus white to me, but I understand the world, especially with what's happening in the world. I'm not ignorant or quiet to not know what's happening around me. I know what's going on. But I think it's always important, Roy, for representation to be everywhere. You need to know and understand that this is who we are as Black people. Whether you accept it or not, because we ain't looking for your acceptance, sis, ma'am, sir. Not looking for your acceptance, okay? Just know that we're here. This is what it is, whether you like it or not. Because Princess has run into some obstacles where that girl has been told no. Since all the media and everything has come around this, she's hit some walls since then. And I think it's just too much for them to accept. And now it's like, oh, damn, what did we do? We allowed this Black girl into this space and she's bringing too much noise. That's the point. That's the point. There needs to be noise made around so many different aspects. And if the HBCU culture is big right now, people are using us, Roy, using HBCUs, and that's a different topic for another day, because baby, I got a whole HBCUs, majorette dance, marching bands. You're using us as a box to check off to say, oh yeah, I donated to an HBCU. We don't need your donation. Okay, we don't need any of that. Don't do that. If you want us here, really want us here, and I think that that's just exactly 1,000%. And I really believe that that's just what it was for me. And I keep saying for me because I'm opinionated like a mother. I said, but it's just me. You know, I just think that people need to accept all sides and all walks of life. If I want to be accepted when I walk into Sprouts or Whole Foods, you know, when I want to be accepted when I walk into to a car lot to buy a car, whether I'm in sweats or a two-piece suit, I want to be accepted no matter what. So inclusion is everything. It's just going to be something that's, it's going to be a fight that's never going to end. We've been dealing with this for the longest, since before my mom was born. So,
well, I cannot thank you enough for your expertise. I'm going to be back down south in a month or two. I'm going to hit you up, see if you can teach me an 8 count. I'll come by your studio and see if I can learn 1, 2, kick and step, ball turn, push, kick, turn,
When you come, I'm going to give you a Jackson State t-shirt because I don't know nothing about family.
That's going to give me a rash. Thank you so much, Diana,
for coming on the show.
And thank you, Dr. Walker, and thank both of you all for going beyond the scenes with us. See you next time.
All right.
Listen to The Daily Show Beyond the Scenes on Apple Podcasts, the iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Explore more shows from The Daily Show podcast universe by searching The Daily Show, wherever you get your podcasts. Watch The Daily Show weeknights at 11, 10 Central on Comedy Central, and stream full episodes anytime on Paramount Plus.
This has been a Comedy Central podcast.
Are you ready for an all-new season of Survivor? You better be, because Survivor 46 is here, and it's 90 minutes of twists and turns you don't want to miss. Better yet, after each episode, there's a brand new episode of On Fire, the only official Survivor podcast. Each week, we go behind the scenes of the episode's biggest moments, taking you into the how and the why things happened. And this season, we're very lucky to be joined by an expert, the winner of Survivor 45, Dee Valladares.
What is up? I'm thrilled to be joining this team and to be giving you my take on how and the why players made the moves they did, what it takes to outwit, outplay, and outlast, and to ask Jeff some questions, because even after 26 days out there, there is still a lot for me to uncover.
Bring it, D. Listen to On Fire, the official Survivor podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.